You were of service to the University of Oklahoma. Then did you become money-driven or service-driven? There's a combination of things going on here with you.
Yeah, I worked at the University of Oklahoma because it was fun and interesting, and you worked with really intelligent people, and we did big things. But there was a transition going on. Bill Bonowski was the president at the time, but I had gone through three provosts in my 5 years at the Health Science Center. And at one point, this chap who was at that time late 20s, early 30s, was doing tenure. There wasn't anybody around to do tenure. And I literally took the stack of tenure documents and went into a room and tried to sign off on tenure because there was just a huge gap in the administration at the university because of massive turnover.
Explain that, tenure.
Tenure was to take professors who had spent years in the trenches, you know, stacking up publications and qualifications and giving them the right to not be fired. So they had job security is what tenure basically gave you.
Wasn't that installed already or you were presenting it?
No, the provost had to sign off on it. I didn't have a provost. So I went and took these documents back in the room and basically approved them on behalf of the provost office at, you know, late 20s. You'd normally have a distinguished physician at the Health Sciences Center carefully go through these.
So you changed the lives of a lot of people sitting in that little room with your signature.
I did. One that I tell all the time is I grew up watching this black and white TV, and I think I learned to speak more as a result of the show than anything. It's called Miss Fran from Storyland. I forget Miss Fran's last name. I'll think of it here in a minute. But she turned out to be a behavioral scientist that was a distinguished professor at the Health Science Center. But she didn't meet certain base qualifications and yet had applied for tenure. And I denied Miss Fran from Storyland tenure, and I'm haunted by that to this day.
Yes, you should be.
Maybe if she's within earshot of this recording, I can say here for the first time publicly, I'm so sorry.
Okay, so we're talking 85, but then the year 1986 comes along.
Mm-hmm.
You became the Democratic nominee for governor of Oklahoma. You've had these whisperings in your ear, but somewhere along the line, you made a definite decision. Tell us about that.
Yeah, here was the sequence. So I'm working for American Fidelity. I've got this fantastic employment contract. I've got cash budgeted to be spent at my discretion. And yet the state of Oklahoma is spiraling down. And George and I had asked me to be the chairman of DHS. That's a big deal. And this is when the governor still had some power. So he designated the chair of DHS. So I'm on this constitutional board, unaffected by the legislature. And I'm chairman of that, and everybody around the table looks to be 70 to 80 years old. But for me, and I'm early 30s at the most, so I run these meetings. We have momentous decisions to make. DHS was the largest agency of the state of Oklahoma, so it was an eye-opener. Then he asked me to be the chairman of a government reform effort. So with the gentleman that ran the city service operation in Tulsa, the two of us were co-chairs. George appointed this guy to be the co-chair because he was obviously the most distinguished business leader in Tulsa at the time. And when it came to appoint somebody from Oklahoma City, he told his staff, find me a nobody. He was having a big fight with the Daily Oklahoman, with the powers that be. They were upset about the allocation of highway funds or something. He said, find me a nobody. And Bob White, Robert White, who worked for George and I, called me up and said, would you serve as co-chair of the governor's 100-member, totally private commission on government reform. I was just thrilled. And then later I found out I made the cut because I was nobody. Nobody knew me. Nobody. Those two experiences taught me a lot about state government. I enjoyed watching the other members of this reform commission because we'd busted up into 10 groups and they'd each take a piece of state government and they'd come back and report. And these are all business folks or completely independent people. They would come back and they'd say, you know, I was always pretty critical of this, but this is really complicated. This is much more complicated than I thought, and so the solutions are going to be very difficult, which was sort of the mantra coming out of there. My reaction, probably because of my age and naivete, was this is a lot simpler than I thought. You know, I always saw these big, massive problems. It was because nobody was making decisions on merit. They were basing it on political influence. Nobody was looking at a cost-benefit analysis. No one was really doing a budget. You know, it was just adding incremental amounts to it. Fast forward, the other thing that happened is I'd met Ed DiBartolo during my work at the Merckx Group. I actually talked to him personally at an event, and said, you need to come to Oklahoma because they're getting ready to change the handle on parimutuel betting. And he perked up because they had Louisiana Downs and they were making a fortune at a couple of other racetracks. And within 2 weeks, I had a massive private jet arrive, and I had Jim Buchanan, who was the guy that interviewed me for internship at David Bourne, his big commercial realtor in Oklahoma City. Jim was kind enough to go find seven sites. We were in the helicopter with the blades twirling, which was a DeBartolo requirement, which violated FAA rules, that we had to have the blades moving because he didn't want to waste any time. So he gets off of his plane, little Italian guy in three-piece suit, doesn't say two words. We get in the plane, we fly these sites, and we're all talking over our headsets and telling him about the various characteristics. Well, his staff had seen these sites in advance, and they had ranked what we then called Lincoln Park Downs as the worst site of all of them because it just didn't work and they didn't like the area and it's going to be too expensive to develop. When we landed, he goes number one, number two, number three. Well, the number one site was Lincoln Park Downs. He completely reversed the order and picked that. So I got sucked into that process simply as a volunteer because I had met and introduced this to him and wasn't being paid for that. American Fidelity got reimbursed some money for my salary because I've spent a lot of time on this at the time. But I get to this point. We have a celebratory dinner that has Governor and Mrs. Nye there and all these officials. And it got around to the governor's race, which was upcoming for 1986. Everybody had an opinion, and we were listening intently, and I had no intention of running. I was up to my eyeballs and busy. Donna Nye finally said, well, you know who ought to run? In a room of 25 people or so, we all lean in with raptured attention. She points across the table at me, and she says, you ought to run. Well, George and I almost climbed under the table because he didn't want to take sides, and here his wife just very publicly said, you ought to run. Literally, that started the process. I went home, started thinking about it, trying to tell Rhonda how we would pay bills. Somehow you couldn't make any money running for governor. And we didn't have any money, really. And nobody knew us. We did a poll, and I had 2% name ID, and those people were lying. They'd never heard of me. I was never in the papers. But Don and I sparked that process of thought. And before you know it, I jumped into the governor's race late. I think I announced in March of 1986. And Mike Turpin was clearly well on his way to winning the nomination.
You're 35 years old at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And had no...
no money.
And really no experience in
no
government, except you did a lot of work leading up to that, I guess.
Well, compared to Governor Stitt, I had a lot of experience. But
right.
Yes, I had no formal experience other than the chairing of the DHS and that Government Reform Commission were two big, important pieces that allowed me to get an interesting perspective.
In the primary, you defeated Mike Turpin. Well, no, there was a runoff.
There was always a runoff for me. I've only run for three offices, and I've been on the statewide ballot 9 times.
Tell us then about that battle with Mike Turpin. Issues or created issues? He was Turpin time, wasn't
yeah.
he, or, and all
yeah.
that?
I love Mike Turpin, and we had a very divisive, bitter battle at the time. We've since become very good friends, but Mike had been to every county. He was DA in Muskogee, and then he became Attorney General and beat a guy who had offended the establishment because of GM tax rebates. And so Mike got to the Attorney General slot. Well, at that point, it was a foregone conclusion that he was going to run for governor, and he worked it to death. I mean, he went to every county. Every county chair was for him. He had lined it up. And then I pop on the scene, and I'm not taken very seriously because nobody knows me. But I think the Daily Oklahoman kind of had fun by giving me more publicity. This is before they decided to turn on me years later, but they had fun giving me quite a bit of press. Then the next thing I know, Channel 4 wanted to find somebody who was running for office who probably wasn't going to make it. They just wanted to pick a candidate and follow them with a camera, film some of it, and have a documentary after the election about what it takes to be a candidate for office. So I have the local NBC affiliate, KFOR, follow me with a camera crew. Early in that campaign, Mike Turpin went crazy because he's out there giving a big speech and rah-rah and carrying on, and here I arrive with a camera entourage, people being interviewed and all this other stuff. And so it gave me early credibility. I remember an early front page story in the Daily Oklahoman that said high touch versus high tech. Because I was always talking about new ideas and new direction, and it's time for change state government and this, that, and the other. Mike Turpin got a hold of that, and he thought it'd be popular to say, I'm not a high-tech guy, I'm a high-touch guy. I look him in the eye, I shake their hand, blah, 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 blah. Well, that was just the wrong thing to say at that moment because we were coming out of a bust. People were looking for change, looking for something different. So it all clicked, and I raised a lot of money. I'd get on the phone and say, you don't know who I am, but I'm running for governor, and here's why. I had people more than once say, how do you spell your name, so they could write a check. I was just intense about calling people and asking for support. We raised enough money in that campaign. It was like $1.8 million, which is just ridiculous in current day dollars. We raised a lot of money, nickels and dimes here and there. Then I hired Washington consultants, Doak and Shrum. We'd never had a full-fledged Washington firm involved. They did brilliant ads. They did the Time's Up. You know, Mike Turpin was, it's Turpin time, and he'd get in that big dump truck and ride down Lincoln Boulevard for his announcement. We just took that and turned it on him and ran a bunch of ads that said Time's Up. We got Mike in a runoff because there was always a whole bunch of candidates, and I led him in a runoff. He was supposed to win without a runoff. I led him in a runoff, and he did an excited interview the night of that election. Obviously, had lost his temper and just couldn't believe what had happened to him. And that interview probably killed him for the general. So we won then the general and went on to run against Henry Bellman.
You talk about raising money. A lot of people say the worst thing in the world when you run for office is that I've got to raise money. You didn't apparently feel that way?
No.
Phone and make that call?
It was sort of a piece of the business. You couldn't be a candidate without it. So it was an essential element to be able to fund a staff, have an office, buy television ads. I guess I looked at it too clinically in terms of just saying, I don't care whether I like it or not, it's got to be done. And nobody's going to be able to do it for me because nobody knows me. And so I just got on the phones and stayed on the phones.
Not everybody said yes. People had to say no. You had to take rejection on the phone, and that had to be.
All the time.
But it didn't obviously thwart your...
Yeah, you got used to it. I mean, it's like, who? What?
Right.
You're not going to win. I had a lobbyist in Tulsa who came to me because I had a little watch party in Tulsa the night of the primary. He came to me and he said, okay, stiff upper lip, young man, you know, gave it a good try. And everybody just assumed I was going to get blown out for that race. And he was the first guy I called after I won the primary.
Did you and Mike Turpin have a debate?
We did. I'm trying to think if we had an individual television debate. We did have a debate during the primary when we had all the candidates. This is when we had Shorty Barnett and Blue Jeans Jenner, and somebody unrolled a urinalysis that they'd taken and accused all the rest of us of being on drugs. So it was the most bizarre TV debate. We've got to find a tape of that. But I'm trying to remember if Mike and I had a televised debate. I'm almost certain we did. I know we had a radio debate one night that Mike got so mad at me. We were in the runoff. You know, I was poking him, and he wasn't used to that, and I feel badly about all that, but he got very angry, and I thought he was going to deck me at one point.
He lost his temper publicly then.
Well, I think what hurt Mike was that he had a towel around his neck, and his team had told him he needed to be a fighter, you know, that he was going to fight for the voters. So the fighting looked like out-of-control stuff. It just didn't come off very well on television at the time that evening. And I think we picked up a lot of people. We jumped up in the polls right after that.